The Atlantic's Graham Wood is living in Tel Aviv right now. And over the last couple of weeks, he says it's been impossible to ignore that some kind of attack was imminent.
And that actually has affected daily life, too. I mean, even something as simple as using GPS on your phone. If you were flying into Ben Gurion Airport recently and you looked at your phone, Google Maps or whatever, it might show that you're actually flying into Beirut or into Cairo.
Huh. Why? Just because it's scrambled?
Yeah, it's been scrambled. So if there's some kind of drone or whatever that's using GPS that's trying to attack El Al flights into Ben Gurion and they're using GPS, they might end up going to Lebanon and attacking a Middle Eastern Airlines flight. So it's just a constant reminder that something's going to happen.
Israel has been on high alert since the beginning of the month.
There is an escalation of tension in the Middle East tonight, beginning in Damascus, Syria.
On April 1st, Israel targeted and killed senior members of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in a consulate building in Syria.
Essentially, what happened today is the decapitation of IRGC leadership in Syria and Lebanon. And it wasn't only
right away. Iran vowed revenge.
And U.S. officials say that attack could come at any moment.
U.S. has issued a travel warning for Israel because of it. And tonight, President Biden.
And then on Saturday.
We begin tonight in the Middle East, where Israel is under attack. Iran launching hundreds of missiles and drones at the country, streaking westwards across the region with explosions illuminating the night sky above Israel and the West Bank, as panicked civilians below rushing to get to safety.
The strange thing about this attack, though, for Graham, is how lucky it made him feel. The damage was minimal, despite hundreds of explosives sailing toward Israel all at once. When Graham got the news of the incoming fire, it was bedtime. The drones were still mid-journey from hundreds of miles away. He figured, I might as well get some sleep. Let the air raid sirens wake me up in a few hours.
Yeah, I thought that Iran had basically set my alarm for me. You know, huh. I was pretty much assuming that I've got a few hours where I can get some sleep. And then after that, it's going to get really interesting.
So did you wake up?
No. To my great surprise, no sirens went off at all. I woke up and looked outside and saw the sun shining on a beautiful April day in Tel Aviv. And that's, as we now know, because the attack never made it into Israeli airspace.
Are things calm now?
I think by the standards of countries that have just had flocks of drones, murder drones and ballistic missiles sent at it, things are pretty calm here. But there's also, you know, a broader sense that there's a new dispensation that Israel is living under with Iran. And in the past, Iran has said, we're going to keep a kind of respectful distance. And apparently that's no longer the case.
Today on the show, after this weekend's attack, the question is, what will Israel do now? I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. I want to go back a little bit, if we can, and talk about how we got here. Because I've done a couple of shows that have basically concluded, and you've said this too, Iran does not want regional war in the Middle East. But the fact that 300 plus drones and rockets sent from Iran just whizzed towards Israel, it seems to belie that conclusion. So I just want to talk about how things heated up in this way.
Yeah, so let me first say the idea that Iran doesn't want a regional war has to be interrogated a little bit. Remember, Iran has disrupted Syria, Iraq, Yemen. Its proxies are attacking international interests left and right. So what it doesn't want is an all-out direct confrontation with Israel. And that seems still to be the case. But it's still thrilled about causing havoc and advancing its interests that way.
So chaos, but not actual war between countries.
Yeah, exactly. It likes to turn up and ratchet up the tension in many different places and take advantage of that when it can. Basically, it's destroyed the country of Syria and much of Yemen in the course of that. So that's just what Iran has done. That's not a change in its strategy. Israel, in addition to going directly after Hamas in Gaza, it's had, as it's promised from the beginning, the strategy of finding anyone who's responsible elsewhere. So that they killed a general in the Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran named Mohammad Reza Zahedi, who was in an annex to the Iranian consulate in Damascus. But this was kind of something new. And that really kicks up the stakes of things, because you're not supposed to attack consulates. It's a violation of international law. And Israel has said, well, it wasn't really the consulate. It was this next door building, and it was being used for military purposes. And by the way, this guy was bad. So when it happened, clearly there was a step that had been taken that could unbalance even the precarious equilibrium that was there before.
You mentioned the April 1st attack. Why did that action necessitate a response from Iran?
Iran and Israel, just like Iran and the United States, there is a kind of understanding of what's allowed and what's not. And whenever one side upsets that understanding, goes too far, then it's also part of this kind of macabre dance that the countries do where they punish the other side. They retaliate as a way of pushing the equilibrium back to the former conditions. So that's what happened on April Fool's Day when Zahedi was killed, where there was an understanding that, yes, the Israelis will pick off Hezbollah leaders, they will pick off Iranian proxies, they'll even pick off Iranians. But there are areas that will be considered sacrosanct, and the areas that are connected to consulates would be among those. This is an ironic thing, of course, because Iran, from its very founding as an Islamic republic, of course, was invading consulates. So it's kind of amusing that they would be sensitive to the same thing happening to them. But that's a very upsetting thing for Iranian security forces to realize that the limits of the Israelis are not what they thought they would be. And that explains, of course, why they thought it was so important to retaliate, because if Israel is going to push further than it has previously pushed, then Iran says to itself, okay, that means we have to push back. And, you know, whatever the revision is that we decide on of how we're going to be treating each other, it wasn't what we thought, and we'll do what we can to make sure that it doesn't move too far.
It's really interesting to me what happened in the days after the April 1st attack, because it was clear that Iran was thinking about retaliation. For about a week, there were headlines like, you know, expect an attack in Israel in the next 2 days, those sorts of things. But it sounds like during that time, the United States also went to allies in the region and basically said, can you help us out, given that we know that Iran is looking to respond here? Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, so the United States, according to reporting from Reuters and elsewhere, went to Arab countries in the region that it has relations with. We're talking about the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Iraq, Jordan. You are in touch with Iran. You talk to Iran. We do not. We do not have relations with them. But we would like you to talk to Iran and deliver the message that they should be measured in their response to Israel, that there are lines that should not be crossed, and do what you can to bring down the tensions. And so there were conversations that were initiated between the foreign ministers of those countries and the foreign minister of Iran, trying to make sure that whatever happened didn't get out of hand.
And then once it became clear that something was going to happen, how did these countries allow Israel and the United States, acting on behalf of Israel, to essentially protect Israeli people?
Yeah, I think the most incredible thing that we saw after the Iranian counterattack was this extraordinary shield that was essentially put up between Iran and Israel by Arab countries whose security alliance is still really fresh. And, you know, for me, as someone who's been reporting in this region for more than 20 years, kind of vertigo-inducing to observe. I mean, what we're talking about here is the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and Jordan jointly helping Israel defend itself against an attack.
This seems new to me. Really new.
It really is. Yeah. I mean, Jordan, of course, has had relations with Israel for several decades. So that's not so new. Saudi Arabia does not have relations with Israel, but does have a kind of security, shared interest, and definitely a security relationship. These countries opened their airspace to Israel and others, and in some cases, probably with their own militaries, plucked out of the air the weapons that were headed toward Israel and saved Israel from suffering serious damage. If 20 years ago you had said Saudi Arabia saved Israel from serious damage, it would have been understood to be some kind of, you're having some kind of aneurysm. There was some malfunction in your understanding of how the world was working. But that's how it worked. Overwhelmingly, the 300 plus projectiles that were being sent toward Israel were destroyed before they even arrived, before they even came within Israel's borders, before we could find out what their intent was. There's some question, of course, like, were the Iranians just lobbing softballs at Israel?
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Like, did the Iranians intend to have what they were sending not reach the destination?
Yeah, and I think that's a possibility. Iran has not been trying to get into an all-out war with Israel. If Israel sent 300 ballistic missiles toward Iran, significantly more than zero of them would land. So they're not trying to get into a exact whatever you do to me, I'll try to do to you type of exchange. So it's quite possible that what they wanted to do was do something serious, do something that showed that they meant business and that they were escalating things to match the escalation they perceived from Israel. But they didn't want it to get so bad that it would mean that Iran would be inundated by Israeli missiles. And it's hard not to read that as Israel basically winning the exchange. And not only that, but winning the exchange at a time when it's had very few wins. It was able to look at its technological supremacy, its capability of having a solid air defense and say, yes, checks out. But also Israel was able to test exactly what they could get out of their allies, out of Jordan, out of Saudi Arabia, out of the Emirates. And yes, all of these countries seem to have been quite helpful, exactly as the alliances were supposed to function. So I think the straightforward analysis of what happened is that Israel kicked things up a notch, and then Iran half-heartedly matched, and then backed down.
Given all that, do you think the Israeli government is interested in standing down?
The Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, who's been embattled, is much hated by the Israeli left and center. So far, his response has been to agree that the Iranian aggression is bad, but not do anything. But let's not be coy about it. Netanyahu and his allies in his very right-wing government are seriously considering whether this might be something that despite the desires of the Iranians, or maybe because of the desires of the Iranians not to be attacked, that something that should be escalated to keep what's happened from being something that is unanswered.
We'll be right back after a break. You've written about an interesting part of this Iranian attack that I hadn't considered. The fact that because the attack was so measured on Iran's part, or seems to have been, since it was so clear that Iran didn't want to widen the war, it seems, it's weakened Hamas's hand in Gaza. And I'm curious if you can dig into this with me, because I think it requires some explanation, but I think it's really important.
The Gaza complication is not a simple matter. But one of the hopes that Hamas seems to have had especially in the early days of the aftermath of October 7th, was that its attack would rally its allies, Hamas's allies, to this flag, the let's fight Israel flag.
They basically come on in, the water's warm.
Exactly. Yeah. We have, at great cost to ourselves, attacked Israel in a shocking way and shown their weakness. So if you other countries that are, you other entities like Hezbollah that are much more powerful than we are, if we're willing to do this, you should too. Now, that, first of all, hasn't happened. This was as close as it has come to happening. That is a much, much larger entity, much more powerful entity, Iran, has demonstrated that this is as much as it's willing to do. If you're waiting for Iran to enter the fight, well, you just saw one version of that happen, and it didn't make a darn bit of difference. So from that perspective, Hamas has one fewer card to play.
You also raise the point that what happened over the weekend basically shows that there are Arab countries who are willing to protect Israel. And those Arab countries, they want to see Gazans in their homes, and they don't really like Hamas. We're talking about this coalition of people who protected Israel from the bombs, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, UAE. And I think that's interesting too.
It is. And one of the possibilities for an aftermath to the Gaza war has always been, maybe you can get Saudi Arabia to pay for some kind of reconstruction. Maybe you can get Emiratis to go in and help create some system of governance that succeeds the administration of Hamas. There's been some talk of maybe they can be persuaded or induced to do that kind of thing. And Netanyahu and his government have effectively blocked all discussion of these things. In fact, many of Netanyahu's partners have said, Israel will be solely responsible for the security of Gaza in perpetuity. There will be no armed force other than an Israeli armed force in this space. And that is a kind of almost crazy maximalist position that is tantamount to saying, we're going to occupy this space forever and the war will never end. So this is unrealistic, to say the least. And now we've got a moment when Israel can look to the leadership of the countries that have really helped it and saved it, and look and see those countries and say, we owe you a debt. And that includes making your people happy, or at least a little happier about how we treat Gaza in the end.
That would assume the Israeli government is operating in kind of normal diplomatic world. Is that where the Israeli government is operating right now?
No, that's a fantasy of how the Israeli government sees itself. The leadership of Israel, of course, is Benjamin Netanyahu, whose government depends 100% on the consent of parties that are extremely ideological and are extremely unsophisticated about the rest of the world. And therefore, the decisions of his government are often not in what seems to me to be the straightforward long-term interest of the state of Israel. So the idea that he would creatively pivot from the inflexible positions and fantasies of how the Gaza war would end just because there's a good reason to do so and a chance to do so right now that didn't exist a week ago, that seems like wishful thinking, unfortunately. So that leaves us exactly where we started, with an inflexible Israeli government meeting an even more inflexible Hamas insurgency, and the people of Gaza right there in the middle suffering till the end.
It sounds like whatever happens next, a lot of it's in Israel's hands. Is that fair?
I mean, Hamas gets a vote, and I think it's important to realize what level of stubbornness Israel is dealing with in trying to come up with deals with Hamas, deals for hostages, ceasefires. And Hamas has simply said no to ceasefires. It has rejected any possibility of a ceasefire. It has rejected the very notion that taking civilian hostages is anathema and has to stop. So It's not an easy entity to deal with. But it's true. You know, Israel is a more powerful entity. Israel has responsibility that it can't wash away merely by pointing at Hamas's irresponsibility.
You sound pessimistic about where things are headed in Israel. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I'm not Israeli, but I think I may have absorbed some of the pessimism of Israelis I've spoken to. So if I sound pessimistic, it's because a lot of Israelis are pessimistic at complaining about this government, watching it blunder into a humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. There's still no straightforward pathway toward a new political reality in Israel, where there might be someone else in charge, someone who's more competent, someone who can lead the country to whatever the next step is. It's as if the country's fate is just intertwined with its least popular, least competent prime minister, and that's a really desperate situation to be in, and I wouldn't blame people for being upset that it's being seemingly forced on them by Israeli politics in perpetuity.
Graham, I'm really grateful for your time and for your reporting. Thank you for coming on the show.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Graham Wood is a staff writer over at The Atlantic. And that's our show. If you're a fan of What Next, the best way to support our work is to join Slate Plus. It's our membership program. Go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Anna Phillips, and Madeline Ducharme. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon.